At the recent U.S. conference of the STM Association in Washington, D.C., representatives of the Future Lab Committee unveiled Tech Trends 2021, an annual look into the future of scholarly publishing. Welcome to Copyright Clearance's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Beyond the Book. As the STM members told me, researchers today find themselves faced with many demands on their time and careers. Rising competition for tenure grants and positions on the one hand, and mushrooming quantities of articles and data on the other. To illustrate these circumstances, STM chose a pinball machine as metaphor for the numerous buffeting forces, including risks and opportunities, that will shape research in the years to come. Panelists included Sam Bruinsma, who has been with Brill since 1998, and is currently Senior Vice President of Business Development, Michael Forster, Managing Director for Publications at IEEE, Deborah Sweet, Publishing Director at Cell Press and Editor-in-Chief of the journal Cell Stem Cell, and, starting us off with the conversation, Heather Ruland-Staines, Director of Partnerships at Hypothesis, a nonprofit in the annotation and collaboration space. Heather, I'd like to start with you if I can, because thinking further about pinballs and talking about them, perhaps a bit too much, because we might have had to give you a trigger warning, because I understand you took up pinball and became something of a wizard yourself. In fact, you had to sort of step away from the pinball table, didn't you?
Well, those of you who know me should not be surprised to find I'm a hyper-competitive person, and I'm not allowed to play games because I take games a little bit too seriously. So if you do happen to come across me ever anywhere playing a pinball game, intervene immediately and make sure that that doesn't happen again.
All right. Well, we'll be careful about that. So keep her away from the table with all those graphics. She might sort of think that's a real table. And Sam Bruinsma, we were talking about the pinball image, and not to go too far into all this, but it is a bit of a relief to be talking about pinball games after a series of presentations we've had over the last few years. You've joined me on several of those where we've been buffeted by waves and tsunamis, we've been sort of wrapped around gears. This sounds like an environment that we might have some fun with, finally. How do you feel about that?
Well, yes, I agree. Last year we had waves and all the other undercurrents threatening this little boat, this little skiff on top of it, which was the publisher. I already mentioned it before, I think. The year before, we had the wheels, and the wheels, there's still some determinism in there, of course, but are we in control, or are we between the wheels? And now, this year, we seem to get back in control again with a pinball machine, but still, we need to play the ball, and we still need to win, of course. So it is.
Right. And yeah, those gears make me think of sort of a Chaplin-esque image of Charlie finally caught up inside the gears themselves. You can get caught up in the game, as Heather might have done, but it's hard to really get sort of dragged into the pinball machine, unless maybe you are in the Tommy opera. Deborah Sweet, there's a lot going on a pinball machine. It's really hard to keep track, and I know that's, for you, the point, the strength of that image is just all the various forces, all the opportunities, all the challenges. There's a lot bouncing around here.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like the game aspect is definitely true. I mean, the fact that it is fun to think about these things, I agree. And so having something fun as a representation is good. What I liked about this pinball representation, I have to say, Efka gives me way too much credit for a contribution to this, because it came to me as a pretty, you presented it as a really well-formed idea, and it was a good idea. What I liked about it is that it has this element of chaos in it. It's got this, there's a lot of stuff here, and it's sort of all baffling around, and we sort of get a little confused about where to go. And that's one of the things that I find sort of exciting and daunting at the same time here, that there are a lot of choices, there are a lot of ideas, there are a lot of options, there's a lot of things we could do, and they're represented on here. And the tough part, actually, the playing the game, is trying to decide which of those we should be focusing on, which to use, because there's more than we can reasonably do, I think.
Michael Forster, what about your strategy for playing this kind of pinball? Any thoughts on that? Do you feel like you've got this under control, or are you still sort of working up to being a wizard?
Under control, definitely not. I think that's the big takeaway for me. No matter how optimistic I am, I don't think it's ever going to feel that way. I think to echo some other observations, I'd say a good thing about the visual is that it emphasizes potentially how interconnected everything is, and you know, whatever the winning trajectory is through this this pinball machine or maze that we have to find, I think it's going to involve different combinations of all of the things that you see on this board, and they'll probably be completely different for different businesses, different publishers, different participants in our scholarly communication ecosystem.
Right,
so the connectedness is the big thing.
Right, and the human element, I think, is for me the part that was the most refreshing. It really, you can't imagine a pinball game without someone playing the game. It's sort of a void without it. And so let's move into the various aspects that Eefke Smit teed up for us, and this particular area of accuracy and curation, predominantly around a peer review, and which has been so much a part of scholarly publishing for centuries. And so that's the human element. But Michael, if I can start with you, to tell us a bit about your vision for where the technology can play a role in peer review, perhaps the place for AI, for example, in that.
Well, I think from my point of view, the observation at the moment is that, as we've heard many times throughout this meeting and previously, peer review is a system, is a process which is creaking under the pressures that are being placed on it by where we are in the scientific endeavor and the publishing business. There's increasing volume of content being published. There are increasing demands on publishers to validate science, to curate content in multiple different formats. We heard a lot about video, but that's really just scratching the surface. We heard from Bernie Rouse about reproducibility and badging. These are all additional burdens that are being placed on what we manage as publishers in order to maintain our position as trusted sources of information. We are going to need AI helpers, because human helpers, human resourcing is a finite part of the equation. But I think if we go back to Shashi's talk yesterday and the questions that followed it, I'd have to confess that I don't know where those AI deployments are going to come from right now. I think I'm very confident that we need to deploy them, but I personally don't have a great deal of knowledge to share or confidence that I know the right answers as to where they will be deployed.
Right. Heather Staines, you have some thoughts on where the help can come from AI, and in particular for peer review. It is not going to replace human input, of course, but it is going to help make the human beings who are working through the peer review process, it's going to help them do their jobs.
Yeah, one of the things that I was really struck by yesterday in a number of the presentations was a repeated notion that the journal editors were inexperienced or somehow asleep, you know, at the wheel. And I do think that it would be great to see how AI and some of these other technologies can act as helpers. But I think to kind of touch upon what Jay mentioned in terms of serving our authors, we're largely an apprentice-type business. We train on the job. Very few of us actually have either a degree in publishing. Probably a small percentage can run through, you know, journals, courses, and things like that. But if you think of a 22- or 23-year-old editorial assistant and perhaps a 26- or 7-year-old editor who's now interacting with authors, you know, some of whom have been doing research in their field for decades, maybe we should think a little bit about some training and credentialing that we can do, both from a mentorship standpoint, but also so that the authors don't come away with this perception that they're dealing with inexperienced folks. I think, you know, we look at the complete human side as well.
All right, and Deborah Sweet, there at your organization, you've been testing peer review in some ways and looking at the variety of challenges, and the fundamental question there, as we've said, is this theme of trust. How are you going about trying to, you know, strengthen people's confidence in what you do, in the confidence of the peer review?
Well, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, you're right, Heather, that it does take experience and confidence to do a good job of being an editor. You're absolutely right. And it's kind of, and it is daunting. I mean, I know when I started doing it, it was quite daunting. I'm talking to Nobel Prize winners and trying to explain to them why I don't want to publish their paper. That's quite scary. And but you build up confidence and knowledge over time, and it does take time. So there's room for training. I mean, it comes. I think there's a lot of discussion about balancing the demands of the authors and the demands of the reviewers. We talked about the reviewers wanting recompense as well, and trying to balance the time that everyone's investing in it. So there is room for automated solutions to help us there. There's room to structure the review process a little better, I think, probably. In terms of us at Cell Press, I mean, we haven't yet come up with a good way of replacing the human touch. The human touch is what does it. And the talking to people and the listening to them and understanding what they're after. I mean, I know we talked on the phone about the things we're doing, you know, in terms of structure of the article, but that's a little different from kind of the trust and integrity of the process per se. I mean, if you want me to talk about the... Were you thinking I would talk about the method stuff here? Or
you could do. Yeah. I was going to bring up. Yeah. So there's this STAR method that you approach a lot of things with, and STAR is an acronym for situation, task, action, and result, I think.
Yes, but not for us.
Okay, then I got that wrong. So, is it an acronym or just?
It is an acronym, and it's something that we've introduced. It's not to do with the editorial process per se, and trust in that, and trust in the peer review. It's more to do with trying to help with reproducibility and make sure that the methods in articles are well described and clear. So it's related to the discussions we had on the first day about really making sure that the underlying methods are detailed as clearly as possible, and it's a structured way to do that.
Well, I understand you don't see it really as a crisis of the way that some people have sort of written headlines around.
The reproducers, but no, I think it's overemphasized. I think science is an iterative process. I think that there are, some of the things that people highlight about you can't always repeat an experiment that someone describes, yes, that's true, but science is always builds on previous results, and it's always been an iterative process, and I don't think there's a new crisis. I think it's an ongoing, science has always been like this, and I think, and we can do more to improve our communication about it, absolutely, but I don't think there's a crisis.
Okay. Well, Sam Bruinsma, you at Brill are in a slightly different position with the emphasis on the humanities, social sciences there, and it's a different kind of scholarly discourse. A kind of debate is baked into that process. And does that have an impact when you hear conversations about peer review? Do you have a special perspective you want to share?
Well, I agree with Debbie that I think science has always been a process of negation and discussion and moving forward. And so if you cannot reproduce material or stuff that has been invented decades ago, that would be strange. In the humanities and the social sciences, it is a bit different. I think the whole pinball machine is a bit biased towards STM and articles, I would say, and while in the humanities, of course, it's more about books. But still, peer review is the standard. Actually, in the humanities and the social sciences, or in book publishing, it's quite common to pay for peer review. Reminding the discussion yesterday about paying peer reviewers. So that's not strange to us, but we don't do it for our journals.
All right. Well, one of the places where there is overlap for you, though, is around data. And I know that at Brill you've just begun to sort of move into what I believe you call digital humanities and looking at data sets, which may be something familiar to people on the STM side of things, but is fairly new for you there. So when we speak about the kinds of services that are possible, we heard about blockchain. What kind of activities for data sets are you anticipating will happen at Brill?
Well, not blockchain for a while, I guess. But in the humanities, especially the humanities that have been mostly qualitative or have been using qualitative methods in the past, like philosophy and history and ethnography, are now actually turning into a much more qualitative endeavor by, for example, digitizing large corpora of texts and mining them for new meanings, new connections. And as a publisher, we are able to support that. We might publish those data sets, but we are also developing self-learning tools to translate these texts that are often handwritten, and also to tag them for future use.
I was thinking about, we should have talked a bit about in relation to the integrity of the peer review process, related to what you're saying about the underlying information. I mean, there's definitely a role for technology in helping us verify the underlying information, the kind of things on here about, you know, data integrity and the validity of what we're presenting. And I think I can see a lot that we could do that would help with that. And there's already a lot of good text-based, the plagiarism detection is excellent, Authenticate is very good. But I think there's a lot we could do in terms of data and images and things like that, and that would really help. And that is something where AI, I think, has a big role it could play.
Right. So again, that gets to that point that technology is enabling some of the fraud, but it is also able to detect it as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically sort of keeping up with it. And I think a lot of it also, certainly from my experience of dealing with image manipulation, because we do screen all of the images that we publish before we publish them to look for manipulation. And my experience is a lot of it also just comes from people not understanding what's appropriate and what's not. It's really just kind of, they just don't get some of the things they've done. It's amazing to me because, like, you know, having the sort of education that I had in the lab was very, it was very clear that you shouldn't do some of these things, and yet people seem to.
Such as them? Is it simply a matter of making things look a little prettier and easier to read?
Stretching your blots. Yeah, I mean, a lot of they think it's just making it look prettier, but actually they're altering the data. You know, covering up background in your fluorescence images with the erase tool like this. It's crazy to me that someone thinks this is okay, but they do. And it's sort of, and then the same with, you know, doing the blots. You sort of, okay, I can squash this and stretch it a bit and then increase the contrast, get rid of that band I don't like, and that's fine, apparently. And it's really not, and I think, but that's an education process because these people are not trying, they're not trying to be misrepresented. They're just not understanding this is not appropriate.
Yeah, Michael Forster.
But I think that, you know, that's an extremely important point to make, you know, that the higher the stakes, and there's some published evidence that, for example, around falsifying data, the higher the impact factor of the journal that you're submitting to, the more likely that data is to be faked in it. But, you know, whenever there are technologies competing, people are going to game systems. Yes, we have, I think, Deborah, you just mentioned Authenticate for plagiarism screening. We at IEEE spend an enormous amount of resource screening all of our content for plagiarism and doing that in a very rigorous and regimented way. I've been told stories by editors and researchers who say that, you know, they've heard behaviors among students and early career researchers about how, you know, if you run a piece of text back and forth two or three times through Google Translate, which we heard about also from Shashi, I think, then you can reformat material so that it will go through that system happily, even though you've added nothing to it. We also regularly hear about fake reviewers, completely fictional reviewers, citation stacking, citation cartels, and all kinds of other behavior that the reward and incentive scheme in the system optimizes people towards exhibiting. And we need to take the next leap forward to deploy whatever technology tools, AI or whatever, to make sure that we can stay one jump ahead of those behaviors. Otherwise, trust will break down.
Well, indeed, and trust is important. And, you know, what we have seen, I think, throughout the world is the way that our habits outside of the workplace, outside of the research lab, wherever we may be professionally, the habits we acquire, you know, at home or otherwise, we bring back to the workplace. And so even when it comes to not just making things look prettier and photoshopping and so forth, but also trolling, that goes on. And Heather Staines, you're at Hypothesis now, an annotation provider, and where I want to ask you about before we move on to the smart services point is this point about integrity. And 2016 was the year of fake news. That was the headline. For a service that's about trying to advance science by having people contribute and comment, what if nobody really trusts anyone today? What if there's no confidence in anyone? Is there a sense that all these efforts to sort of build community are being undermined by that lack of trust?
I think it's easy to fall into a cycle where we're just depressed because no one can believe anything anymore. You know, why bother? We're just talking to ourselves and inside little bubbles, and we only follow the people who believe the same things that we believe. I've been thinking about this a lot lately because there are groups who are using a Hypothesis and tools like Hypothesis to try to correct misinformation. We're working with a group called Climate Feedback. It's 200 climate scientists organized out of UC Berkeley, and they're global. And whenever an article comes out in the news about any aspect of climate change, they disperse it amongst themselves according to specialty, and in 24 hours, they have posted on their website what they call a feedback, which includes information on who annotated the article, a score, and you can link out then to the article in context over the Boston Globe or the Guardian or wherever the original piece was published, and they will have annotated line by line, this piece of information is not correct, this piece of information is out of context. And what we want to do is find other communities who are passionate about their subjects, whether it's immunization or immigration or fracking, and try to give them a workflow tool so that they can make their information, their expert annotations, publicly readable. They can determine whether they want to interact with anyone else or whether that those annotations are, in a sense, content. But the amongst the group of climate scientists, I mean, they're not always on the same page with everything. It's not that there's one uniform view, but as credentialed scientists, they largely play nicely in a civil manner with each other. So as we expand this technology to other groups, it will be up to the groups to decide who will write annotations, who will read them. And, I mean, it's one of the things, you know, I was thinking about the whole, you know, registered traveler program earlier. How do you decide as a community who to include? But we don't want it to just be limited to, you know, experts. The idea with annotations is that regardless of which service you use, annotations you make across the entirety of the web should talk to annotations made through other services. And through that mechanism, you can decide, I would like to listen to public commentary. Here are varying layers of experts. Here are practitioners. Here's maybe a globally focused layer. So giving people options, and we think that there will grow a community of trust amongst these groups, and the folks who are misbehaving, you know, they'll be kind of voted down, so to speak, by other communities.
Right. And this image of the pinball machine, as we've said, there's a lot of activity going on, and sometimes it can be almost too much activity. And so for researchers, sorting out the noise, sort of getting that signal-to-noise ratio right, is really a challenge. And Heather, technologies that may work in a positive direction to sort out the noise, to provide researchers with what the information that they're looking for, to help them discover things they didn't know were there. Talk about the potential for that, to really sort these things out. It's made a mess of a kind, but it could also sort this out.
Well, I don't know. We're all drinking from the fire hose these days, so I'm not sure that, you know, any one technology is going to stop that from happening. I mean, from a personal standpoint and a workflow solution, I've told so many of you this already. I've become obsessed with annotations. Again, not surprising given my personality, but if we have the ability at one time and in one place to see every, I'm going to call them comments. Annotations are different than comments, but it's an arguable distinction. If you have the ability to see every annotation, every comment you made across the web ever in one place and tag it and search it, and not only your annotations but other public annotations that people are making, I think it it opens up communications channels, it opens up exploration of the data that you didn't maybe have possible before. And so it's one method that works for me, but I'd love to hear about methods that work for other people and trying to sort that out as well.
Well, I was going to actually turn towards another very promising aspect of technology development, which is what's called voice-based navigation. And I know that as a former researcher yourself, Deborah Sweet, that strikes you as having a lot of potential. And what, if I understand it correctly, it would do is sort of erase or vaporize the interface. And so I could be in a lab and not have to worry about, excuse me, getting to my device. It would just, I could speak and things would happen for me.
Yes, I mean, you know, I fantasize about the future where we will have situations where we're not dependent on a device and we'll be able to do something. I mean, I have these visions of being able to navigate data within the context of some kind of, you know, projected thing in front of my brain.
A hologram of something.
Yeah, exactly. It's something like that. And I mean, I can imagine that would be really exciting to be able to do. I mean, it's very futuristic. We're clearly not there right now. But the voice activation is one part of that, and you imagine if you could be standing there in the lab and you say something like, has anybody ever looked at whether this does this before, and it comes back to you rather than you having to kind of go to your computer and type it in. I mean, that would be really interesting to do. And related to what you're saying, Heather, I mean, maybe you could, if that was part of the screen, if you could say, well, what do people think about this idea? And if you could mine all of that information. I mean, you know, AI can do all sorts of wonderful things. If we could mine that and get that answer back, that would be really interesting. So you can imagine things like that in the future that could help us with it, to help us navigate. Because you're right, I mean, navigating the sheer volume of information and sorting out the wheat from the chaff is a huge challenge for everybody.
Right, and Michael Forster, navigating and sorting out, these are tasks that I believe you are working at IEEE with on a project called Code Ocean, which is an environment to deposit data, to preserve all these things, and to kind of be in a real-time environment. That sounds like something that a researcher would really find valuable.
Well, I think we heard from Pierre from Code Ocean yesterday, and that's one particular effort that we've very much endorsed at IEEE to allow researchers to make algorithms and code and data available alongside their published articles so that other users can use those artifacts and rerun the code with their own data and so on. I think that that's a very significant step in adding reproducibility validation to the publishing process. We've also run a workshop sponsored by NSF and including many publishers represented in the room here as part of the process to try and figure out what reproducibility as part of publishing will look like in the future. And I think these are just the first steps on that road, though. And as I mentioned before, I don't have a great degree of certainty or confidence about any of the particular paths that we're going to take being the absolute right ones, but I guess that's the pinball machine analogy again, that we have to keep experimenting and trying all of these different potential applications of technology to find the right one. I had a thought about blockchain, by the way. I don't know whether you could tell before that I'm still slightly puzzled by quite what an impact blockchain is going to make on our industry or the world in general. But it did strike me that this is something that obviously is very important in the context of the energy industry and miners. And so I think that the administration here in Washington is going to think that the blockchain is huge. Sorry.
I liked what Avka said. She was still confused, but at a much higher level. And yeah. That summed it up for me.
In all seriousness, I have imagined ways in which you could use blockchain technology to authenticate the underlying data that goes into research. You know, have those be, I mean, that also might be huge. But I think, it, you know, it. I'm not. I don't, based on the talks today, I'm not sure it's quite there yet. But one of the presentations we heard back in December was from that startup that's using it to authenticate art, which I thought was a really, really good application of it. And you could imagine it being used in the same way to authenticate underlying data in science. Well, and to sort of, you know, the time stamping of it.
For example, you can have a blockchain authenticated kind of chain of title from the data that comes off an instrument in a lab through to that image that appears in a publication, then you know that might be something that achieves a level of credibility reinforcement that becomes very important.
Mm-hmm. And with the idea that you could go all the way, from, I mean, if you're storing all your data electronically right from the beginning in your notebook, I mean, all of that ends up being very integrated through to the public. Mm-hmm. I mean, through the publication. Yep. I mean, this is again pie in the sky, but it's not impossible.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. This year, and it was admitted by our presenters, that it's the year of blockchain. There's a lot of discussion around that, a lot of investment around it. And Sam Bruinsma, you reminded me that it was only a few years ago that MOOCs were perhaps not in quite as big a space, but they were getting quite a lot of attention. And this is the challenge around technology trends, is things sort of flare up like some kind of nova, and then we don't know how long that nova is going to remain in the sky for us. And you have seen an interesting development there with MOOCs, that the massive piece perhaps isn't quite as massive as anticipated, but it is still an important element on the board here. And tell us about that.
Well, I think we all see it. The real massive online courses movement, I think it not died away, but never really developed further. But we do see a lot of online colleges at universities. So flipping the class where it originally started is still happening everywhere. And these are smaller MOOCs. I know also of companies, smaller publishers, that are actually developing topical MOOCs or topical online courses and selling them, so to speak, to smaller colleges, to community colleges. So that's a different development. And that might go further and further. And I think, for example, or especially textbook publishers might be interested in this development.
Yeah, just...
You are our MOOC specialist,
of course. If I hear MOOC, it pricks up my ears. Mm-hmm. I mean, I haven't followed it as much in the past 6 months as I did prior, but we did a really interesting panel at the Charleston Library Conference in November, and... at that point, the most recent year of data was 2015, and more students had taken a MOOC in 2015 than had taken it combined in the 3 years prior. But the big thing is it's online education. Like, I wish the term MOOC had never been invented. It's a horrible term. But universities know how to do online education now in a multitude of different ways. Georgia Tech has two master's programs that they're running in conjunction with MOOCs, and they're a lower cost to degree program. It's like $7,500 a year versus, you know, something like $60 if you come to campus. Arizona State University has a thing called Global Freshman Academy where you can take your freshman year online in a MOOC setting for credit, and then you only need to spend 3 years worth of tuition and fees on campus. So there's all kinds of amazing things that are happening in the space. The largest MOOC provider now is FutureLearn, and that should be no surprise to anyone because the Open University has been doing correspondence and interesting things in education for a long time. So while I like the term MOOC going away, because I think it's a horrible term, wonderful things are evolving out of the MOOC space.
Right. Well, and another area where we heard a lot about just a few years ago, and we're still, of course, hearing about Facebook and the headlines, but Deborah Sweet, you're very much an enthusiast for social media in the STM space, and I think that's interesting to hear about. In fact, you admitted that you have a lot of fun on Twitter. So what kind of fun are you having in that office there that we should know about that is professional fun on Twitter?
Yeah, no, it's very professional. I mean, you know, I'm a professional on Twitter all the time. I mean, I'm very conscious of the fact that I'm representing my company in my journal, but it's been a really interesting way to interact with people. I mean, I started it as a marketing That was the point. But it's been a way of gathering information, getting feedback, having you know, we do little fun contests and quizzes. I mean, it's just really enjoyable. And I actually get a lot of information too. I mean, a lot of my industry information comes from following things on Twitter. So and Heather's nodding, so I think she probably has the same thing. So I think it's as an information source and as a way of interacting in a different way with my audience, it's been really enjoyable.
And you've been able to recruit authors.
I did recruit. Actually, a couple of times, yeah. I mean, one time I had a Twitter conversation about someone who was thinking about submitting a paper. We actually ended up switching to a private conversation because these things are a bit private, and recruited the paper that way. And then also someone who we chose to write a preview article was because they'd been commenting on it on Twitter, and when I looked at them and thought, well, they'd be relevant to write a commentary, and so we asked them. It came from that, and he was thrilled. He was completely thrilled, and thought this was incredibly cool, and tweeted about it, which was great.
Right.
So I think I would advocate for it as a way of having a different kind of interaction with the audience.
Right, and serving research is the piece that kind of underlines all of that. And Michael Forster, you've spoken to me about the change in publishing, the evolution that publishing is about public. Discourse, obviously, and it was a public square of a kind in a printed way, and today we're online, and that expansion that includes the tweets that Deborah's speaking about and videos and everything else, that is fundamentally serving IEEE to assist its researchers to do their jobs and spread the word of their work.
Yeah, absolutely, and you know, let me go back to the connectedness point again and sort of note that the things that people are doing take place in many, many different venues. And one of the things that IEEE, along with other similar organizations of membership, are doing is trying to link those activities together. I mean, we have a huge amount of usage on our journal content platform, but we also manage information and interact with people around the huge conference activities that we run, the millions of users that IEEE Spectrum has online, the information we have about people as they take part in our membership organizations, our technical societies, and you know, these are all things that can be appropriately brought together so that we can provide better services, better targeted information, whether it's content or experience, to individuals. And I'm very pleased to have heard the progress being reported about RA21 earlier this morning that I think is going to enable the whole of the industry to move toward that direction. I think actually we'll be seeing that happen and have more of an impact on our ability to make the discovery process easier for our communities than asking Siri or Cortana to help find something useful for us in the shorter term. But that connectedness of experiences and data, I think, is going to be really important in the short term.
So with that, I want to thank our panel, Michael Forster, IEEE, Sam Brunsma from Brill, Deborah Sweet from Cell, and Heather Staines from Hypothesis. Thank you all.